Of Anah and Mekach Toes. So just to review a little bit, the Torah speaks about a prohibition of cheating somebody when you sell merchandise. That is derived in the pasuk in Parshas Bahar in Sefer Vayikra. When you conduct a sale of merchandise, either as the buyer or the seller, you're not allowed to cheat the other person. If you're a seller, you're not allowed to charge too much. If you're a purchaser, you're not allowed to get away with paying too little. And we spoke about the different gradations of ona'a. This is called altonu, isha sachiv. So the word that's used to describe this prohibition is ona'a. It's ona'as mamon. It's a cheating in terms of the sale of merchandise. And this is an iser d'oraisa to swindle somebody with a price that's too high or paying a price that is too low. That's ona'a. Yes.
Is there no responsibility to the buyer at all? It's all on the seller?
So with respect to ona, we said there is a responsibility on the buyer, that buyer, if it turns out that he paid too little, so then he, if he took advantage of the fact that the seller was a novice or was somebody who was not sophisticated, so then the purchaser also bears responsibility. It's a responsibility on both the purchaser and the seller. But there's an additional responsibility imposed on the purchaser. Let's say that it turns out that the purchaser was charged too much by the seller. So we say that the amount of time that the purchaser can claim ona'a in terms of revoking the transaction is only the amount of time that he could reasonably show the merchandise to somebody else who's an expert in terms of appraising merchandise, and to find out that he was overcharged. But if the purchaser waits beyond that amount of time when he could have reasonably shown the merchandise to somebody and who knows and realized that he was swindled and doesn't take advantage of that window, then the purchaser has no right to claim ona'a afterwards. Okay, that was in terms of ona'a. But we pointed out, and this is the category that we were speaking about afterwards and we're still speaking about, there's a secondary category that people sometimes confuse with ona'a, and that is bitul mekach. That is what we might call mekach toes, more accurately. That is if there is simply a mistake in the transaction altogether. What's the difference between the scenario of ona'a and the scenario of mekach toes? So ona'a is a situation where the person received the merchandise they thought they were receiving. It's just that maybe it's worth more than they thought it was worth, or it's worth less than what they thought it was worth. But the merchandise is what they thought they were getting, right? They thought they were buying a girl, chasing a balloon, and it was really the girl chasing the balloon, right? But mekach toos is when a person thinks they're getting one thing, but it turns out that they actually received something else. They thought they were getting a top quality esrog. It turned out that they really were getting a lemon. They thought they were buying a Rolls Royce. It turns out they bought a lemon. They ended up with something different from what they had paid for, what they had bargained for. And therefore, the rules are different when we deal with mekach toos than when we deal with ona'a. So mekach toos, there is no expiration to the window of when a person, when they discover that they simply received the wrong merchandise, has the ability to back out. It could even be 3 weeks later. A person can discover that they have the wrong merchandise as long as they don't use the merchandise after they realize that it's a mistaken product. They always have the right to back out from the transaction. Another difference is that when it comes to...
Why is it? Why shouldn't there be if he had an opportunity to check the merchandise and discover that he bought the apples, he was delivered oranges. So why don't we say, look, you had a certain window of opportunity to check, you know, like with the other case.
Because by definition it's null and void. By definition it's null and void, unless the person actually demonstrates that they have a desire for the sale to be valid by using the item. Now, it's true that if they wait a really inordinate amount of time to raise their claim, so that counts the doubts, that casts doubts on the veracity of the validity of the claim that they are making, because if it's a close call as to whether it really was defective merchandise or not, you can ask the question, well, what took them so long to register their claim? So it certainly creates a reusa if they wait an inordinate amount of time.
But if you wait 3 weeks and he could have sold it to somebody else had he returned it earlier, what about that? You're hurting him now to sell it.
Lost opportunity.
Right.
In other words, you didn't return it right away.
If it's something where there should be an awareness that the seller could lose out, so that's something that the post can talk about. Certainly if it's the seller that just has the window of opportunity to be able to make back the sale, if this sale is going to be canceled, so that is something that the post can talk about.
Well, now another, yes. Part of the seller.
I'm sorry?
What if the toes is on the part
if
the of the seller?
If the toes is on the part of the seller, even in the case of Monar,
the Rolls Royce instead of the Chevy.
The seller also has the right to back out as soon as the seller finds out. Now, the difference between the seller and the purchaser is in the case of Monar, is in the case of Monar, after the seller sells the item and gives it to the purchaser, the seller doesn't have the ability to just show the item to the local merchant to figure out whether they charge the right price. So the seller has a little bit more of a window until the seller comes across similarly situated or similarly like merchandise, which the seller can then compare and see, oh, is the price that I charged along the lines of what the price is that's being charged by these other merchants who are selling similar products to what I just sold. But in the realm of Mekach Tos, it's basically the same deal between the seller and the purchaser. They both can back out whenever they recognize that they were cheated. Now, the one who was the beneficiary who received, you know, too much money, let's say, because it turned out to be defective merchandise. So let's say the seller wants to back out. So once the purchaser indicates that he or she is interested in maintaining the sale, so then the seller, unless it's just a diametrically different object altogether, but if it's just that it was supposed to be superior quality, it's inferior quality, it was supposed to be a good car and it's a bad car, or something to that effect, as opposed to it was supposed to be apples and it turns out to be oranges, where there's just no semblance whatsoever. So then we say that purchaser who ended up with a lemon, who ended up with a car that is inferior, or ended up with merchandise that is inferior, once the purchaser indicates that he or she would like to keep the transaction, at that point in time, the seller can no longer back out. However, one thing that we don't have in a Mekach Tos context is the ability for a person, generally speaking, we don't have the ability for the purchaser, like in the Onar context, if they were cheated exactly 1/6, so then they can say that they want the price differential of how much they overpaid, but they'll keep the item. When it comes to Mekach Tos, it was just defective merchandise. If we determine that the item is genuinely defective, so then we'll say that if the purchaser comes to the seller and says, oh, I just want the price differential, because it turns out the merchandise is defective, the seller can say, you're claiming that it was defective merchandise. That means that you're claiming that the sale is void. Either keep the item if you like the item, but if you don't like the item, so just return it to me and I'll give you the money back. But you don't get this intermediate remedy that you can just receive the price differential. Now we'll see that's not an absolute rule, it's the general rule. Another difference that we describe between Mekach Tos and Onah is that Onah doesn't apply to certain types of items. Like, for example, it doesn't apply, according to the Gemara, to real estate. Real estate, that you can, some say that if you charge more than double the value of the real estate, there's Onah. But if it's more than 1/6, which is the usual measurement for Ona'a, then that would not be a deficiency or an invalidation with respect to a sale or purchase of real estate. Okay, so the buyer wouldn't be able to claim that they were defrauded, that they were cheated, and vice versa. However, that's only if the buyer receives a piece of real estate that they thought that they were getting. But if there's something defective about the real estate, there's flooding, there are other problems with the real estate, then that is a claim not of onah, that's a claim of mekaktos. You can make a claim of mekaktos even with respect to real estate, even with respect to shtaros, the bills of sale, the types of things that would be excluded from the normal domain of onah. Would those the laws of mekaktos would apply to those items. Now, we discussed a couple of scenarios last time. If you take a look at the sheet, we had a number of cases that come in front of the Beis Din in the realm of mekaktos. So we said that the first case that we discussed last time was a woman ordered a set of customized chairs to match her dining room chairs, was sent pictures to view the final product. When they arrived, she discovered there were slight differences in design. Is she entitled to receive her money back? Anybody remember what the basic consideration was in this case?
She got pictures of the items.
She had pictures. She had the ability to review the items. This is a very important discussion in the context of mekaktos, and that is, what if, you're talking about buyer responsibility, what if the buyer had the opportunity to review the item and see that there were defects in the item beforehand? So the Magen Mishnah says, whenever the buyer had the ability to review the item but didn't take advantage of it, and the defects would have been readily recognizable if the buyer would have just taken the time to look, so then the buyer is not allowed to claim that it was a mistaken purchase, or that it's defective merchandise or a fraudulent transaction. They are stuck with the deal. That's the opinion of the Magen Mishnah. The Sma, Paskins like the Magen Mishnah, Sma on the side of the Shulchan Aruch. The Mishnah Lamelech and most authorities disagree with the Magen Mishnah, and they say that based on a reading of the Rambam and of the Shulchan Aruch, it seems that the only time in which the buyer forfeits their ability to rescind the sale is when the buyer recognizes that there is a defect but continues to use the item afterwards. But if they didn't continue to use the item afterwards, then even if they could have realized that there was a defect, we don't mention this as a type of scenario where they can no longer rescind the sale, since that's not explicitly carved out from their prerogative to back out from the transaction. We say we don't impose this burden of buyer beware upon the purchaser. And even if they could have checked it out, unless it's something which is like blatant and obvious to everybody, like, you know, somebody gives a piece of a copper, like a copper ring to an individual and says, here, take this gold ring. Okay, I'm selling you this gold ring, so thank you for the gold ring. And he's staring at it, and anybody can see that it's copper. It doesn't require any investigation whatsoever. It's just as clear as day that they're using different terms, right, that it's not what it's being claimed to be. So then it's pretty much agreed that the buyer can't make that claim afterwards. But if it's something that is not readily identifiable in an obvious way, but just if the buyer had done some research, had looked carefully at the pictures, like in this case, the buyer would have been able to notice that there were some scratches. So in such a case, that's the machlokas between the Magen Mishnah and the Mishnah Lamelech. We said that the way that the Maharsham in his Sefer Mishpat Shalom resolves this machlokas is he says it depends who's the muksak. Was the money paid yet or was the money not paid yet? If the money wasn't paid yet by the purchaser, then the purchaser can still claim that this is defective merchandise, I don't want to pay. But if the money was already paid to the seller, so the seller can then say to the purchaser, you had the opportunity to check it out before and you didn't do so, so therefore you forfeited your right to rescind the transaction. So that's what we said in this particular case. The woman who ordered this customized chairs had already paid the money, she did not have the same ability to assert that this merchandise was defective when she was sent pictures to view the final product. What made this case even stronger was that it wasn't only that she was sent pictures, she asked for the pictures, meaning that she specifically indicated that she was going to review the pictures beforehand, and that would place perhaps a larger burden of responsibility upon her. Also, when the merchandise arrived, she signed for the merchandise, which indicated that she was approving of the quality of the merchandise because she signed for it. That's what some posts can say, that if you sign for it, I don't know if that's so compelling nowadays. You get a Federal Express package or UPS package, it doesn't mean that you have examined the contents of the box. So that's not quite as strong an argument. Right.
What if she signed the specs before they were produced?
So if in fact what was produced was exactly in accordance with the specs, so then that obviously would weaken her argument as well. So that's case number one.
She bought the table and the chairs, or just the chairs?
It was just the chairs. These were specially customized chairs that she had purchased. Now, one thing that we mentioned is that, let's say that the scratches are very, very slight. Does that count as mekaptos, that it's only a very slight problem? So it really depends on the level of care and concern that would be expressed by most people for this type of a chair. If the minhag medina, if the general custom is that people are very, very meticulous, that these chairs that they're using for their dining room be just so and be just perfect, so then any scratch it might enable the purchaser to invalidate the transaction. The Nesiva Samishpa, his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, says that when it comes to these matters, it's really very much a case-by-case determination of the Beis Din as to whether the defect was so intrinsic to the definition and characterization of the item that it would give a prerogative to the purchaser to cancel the transaction if this defect was in existence. Now, one thing that we look at is how much that was this person just a very picky individual, and how much was it known to the seller that this person was very picky? So we say if a person's an istinist, they're very delicate, they're very particular, everything has to be just right, they're OCD. And it's known that this individual is OCD, so then, even though the seller might not have that same high level of responsibility towards everybody, the seller would have it towards this individual. Okay, this is just, again, by way of review. Let's talk about the next case. A couple contracts for remote control window shades to be installed in their house. The couple gives the down payment, but after the work is performed, discovers that one of the shades is misaligned and holds off on the remainder of the payment until it is fixed. The decorator insists that it cannot be fixed because there is something wrong with the window, making it difficult for the shade to be properly placed. In other words, the purchaser is saying the problem is with the shade, and the decorator is saying, no, the problem is with your windows. Don't blame my innocent shades. While the couple insists that it is his job to suit the shade or to the window. The decorator, in frustration, leaves the job uncorrected. The couple decides to find a new decorator firm and cut their losses, not insisting on receiving their deposit back. The decorator then sues for the remainder of the payment, and the couple countersues for a return of their deposit. How should the case be decided? So there's a whole discussion about, let's say I have a bunch of items that are ordered, only one of them is defective. There's one item that is defective. So can the purchaser cancel the transaction with respect to the other items as well? So the Shulchan Aruch says, well, it really depends. If each item is able to exist in its own right and is not dependent upon the other items as part of a set, so then if one item is defective, that doesn't give the purchaser the right to cancel the sale with respect to the other items. They still are on the hook with respect to the other items. But if it's understood that it is one collection, that it's one set, that every single part of this contraption depends upon every other part, and you really wouldn't be able to have this network of window shades if even one of them is not perfectly aligned, because it is a whole presentation of the set as a whole. So then if one of them is not aligned properly, it would give the right to the purchaser to cancel the entire sale. In this case, we're talking about purchasers who clearly wanted something that was very fancy. Most people do not arrange for remote control window shades to be installed in their home. And this was a floor-to-ceiling type of window display in a fancy home where parlor meetings were held and things of that sort, where the appearance and the impression was very important to this couple, and they were paying top dollar for it and so forth. So therefore, the Beis Din in this case came to the conclusion this really did constitute a defect, that if it couldn't be corrected, that's part of what they were paying for, is that the decorator should figure out some way to align the shade to the windows, and if that's something that could not be corrected and the decorator was not prepared to correct it, then they did have the right to back out of the transaction under those circumstances.
Well, you're making the argument that the decorator, if there's something wrong with the window, that was the job of the decorator when measuring the windows, to be able to anticipate that something's wrong with the window.
And then to have pointed that out to them before the whole installation took place. So all of this was part of the price, shall we say.
Right.
The only thing that we would not mechayev in this case, the decision of the Beis Din, was that the couple, now the under these circumstances, of course, the decorator would have the right to say, okay, you don't want to pay me, give me all of the shades right back. So they were prepared to give all of the shades back, but he didn't want them. He said, I only prepared them for this particular home. They wouldn't fit anywhere else, so he didn't want them back. But the fact that they're not capable of being returned, according to the halacha, does not change the fundamental din, the fundamental law when it comes to mekach tos. If it's something that can be returned, it's supposed to be returned. If for whatever reason it's impossible to return them, and the person who was manufacturing them or delivering them knew ahead of time that the nature of this product is that it wouldn't be able to be returned, so then they can't insist on the tit-for-tat equation of saying, I'm not responsible unless you're able to return something viable to me. They have to recognize that it was understood if it's not going to work out, they're not going to be able to get something viable in return, but they still have to release the purchasers from the transaction. So therefore, we exempted the purchasers from having to pay the remainder of the amount. But what about with respect to what they already paid? So this was a very special case. So remember, Bezdin always tries to fashion a pshara to the extent that it can, or mishpat emes, or mishpat shalom, shift to b'sharechem, a harmonious resolution. It was clear that they were prepared. They just really wanted to walk away from this deal and not be on the hook for more money. They didn't care so much about getting the money back that they had already paid for, say, 50% of the job. Figure this person worked and he, tried hard, and they wanted to sever the relationship and not be liable for the rest, but they were mokel on that amount of money. Meaning that there are two considerations over here. One is that who brought this case, this din Torah? It was brought by the decorator who wanted to recover the remainder of his money. They had paid half, and he wanted to recover the other half. They would not have gone after him for the first half to recuperate or to receive a reimbursement first half that they had paid if he did not go after them for the other half. But once he went after them, that he wanted the remainder of their payment, so then they wanted to recover the amount they had already paid. So it's the machlokes Chacham Tzvi and the Ketzos as to whether if a person wouldn't have asserted a claim if not for the fact that the other individual brought a different claim against them, so something that they would have waived before, they now are asserting, so are they allowed to assert at this point in time? We paskin that they really are allowed to assert at this point in time, but we felt that it wasn't merely that they didn't express that they wanted to recover the money. Through their actions and through their gestures, it was really an outright mechila. And if somebody makes an outright mechila, it's not merely that they withhold or refrain from asserting a claim, but they actually are mochil, they outright forgive a claim, so then they can't assert it afterwards. Even if circumstances change, they can't assert it afterwards. So we felt that the circumstances in this case, and this is not related to the whole mekach tos story per se, but we felt the circumstances were such that they really constituted an outright mechila, so therefore we made a pshara in this case that nobody owed anybody anything. Whatever money had been paid, the decorator could keep, and whatever money had not yet been paid did not need to be paid. That was case number two. It's not mechila betos, because they were mochel even knowing that the job was not properly done. They figured, okay, we're nice people, and we don't think he deserves anything, but whatever he gave him, we're mochel that he can keep whatever we gave him.
But if they knew that he was going to not drop the whole thing...
No, but that's a change in circumstances. That doesn't take away from the mechila in terms of the underlying claim that they had. Because that would be a consideration if they simply weren't going to assert the claim, as opposed to if they outright were mochel the claim. It's a very fine-tuned distinction. Again, in this case, it was for purposes of pshara.
If the homeowner would have said, I don't want pshara, I insist on din, would you have said they get back every penny?
That's an old question that we've been asked before. Generally speaking, the Bezdin does not agree to decide a case according to strict din, because we're not supposed to, Bizman. That's a Yerushalmi. That we feel that the Dayanim, even in the days of the Gemara, they said that the quote of Rav Yossi, I think, is saying that we don't really know how to decide cases properly according to strict din. We're not on that level. So therefore, the Shulchan Aruch says, if in the time of the Talmud Yerushalmi, they weren't on the level able to decide a case according to strict din. So who are we to say that
we can decide
according to strict din? So we generally insist that when parties come to the best and they agree to give the best and the power to inject a little bit of pshara into the decision. Not that the case should be fully pshara. It's what we call pshara kropa ledin. When we decide cases generally speaking, looking into what is the strict din, but giving us the right to make slight adjustments for pshara purposes. Okay, it's a good general question. Let's turn to
question.
Yes.
Do the new decorator use the old materials and make it work, or do they have to produce entirely new shades?
That is the sequel to the Beis Din case, and we don't know exactly what happened afterwards. Said we didn't require that they report to us.
Rabbi, yes. Come out to measure. It's got to be his fault.
Well, that's what we were saying. That was really the conclusion that the Beis Din came to, that it wasn't really measured or anticipated properly.
Okay, can they order him to remake the piece?
So you're saying that is there the right
specific performance?
If it's something, yes, in the sense that this is what they wanted him to do, and if that can be done, this is another comment by the Sma. The Sma says that you can always get out of a Mekach Tos claim. Let's say a purchaser says this is defective merchandise, but the seller has the ability to take steps in order to repair all of the defects and to make the product exactly the way that it's supposed to be. So if the seller has, without necessarily changing what it was, just, you know, fixing something here and there and making it, you know, a more perfect product exactly the way that it was ordered. So if that can be done, so then the Sma says that the purchaser can insist on a complete revocation of the transaction because the seller can say, I'm going to fix everything, if the seller can really fix everything. That's really what the purchaser wanted over here, but the seller just couldn't do it. The seller just either couldn't do it or wouldn't do it. There was a little bit of a machlokus about it. It just wasn't happening. That's why the relationship needed to be severed. Okay? So now let's take a look at question number 3. Reuven purchases a condominium apartment to use as a sales office and communicates this intention to the seller. However, after moving in, he is given a hard time by the building manager and eventually is informed that the unit is not even zoned for commercial use. Now, it happens that in this case, the building manager was apparently a difficult person. This was a case at the Beis Din before my time. Okay, a case before my time. And part of the negotiations for the transaction was that the seller, Shimon, reassured Reuven, said, whatever you do, while we're negotiating this transaction for you to buy this condominium unit, do not speak to the building manager. Because the building manager is very prickly, because really he wanted to buy this unit for himself. So he's kind of like upset at you. So just don't say anything until the transaction is finalized, and then everything is going to be honky-dory, and don't worry about your relationship with the building manager. And that turned out not to be the case. So that was one of the allegations of Mekach Tos over here, is that the building manager made their lives a living Gehenna. After they moved in, apparently he was not very kindly predisposed to them, based on maybe that he wanted the unit or for whatever other reason, and he just made life Gehinnom for them. Okay, so that was claim number one. Claim number two they had is that they had made it very clear to the seller, to Shimon, that they wanted this unit use for sales purposes. It was going to be a sales office, and they received reassurances that, yes, of course, this is zoned for that purpose, even some evidence that the zoning was in compliance with their ability to use the space as a sales office. And then they discovered, after they had already purchased the property, lo and behold, what do you know, it's really not zoned for that use after all. Okay, so Shimon the seller says that Reuven should have done more diligence to determine if the space was properly zoned. Can Reuven rescind the sale and receive his money back? Now, if so, secondary question, is Shimon entitled to recover rent for the period that Reuven owned the apartment? Because once we say the sale is voided, if Reuven was using the apartment for a period of time before he discovered that he's not really allowed to use the apartment as the sales office, so then it turns out it wasn't really his apartment. It was really Shimon's apartment the entire time. So maybe he owes rent to Shimon. Even though he can rescind the transaction, maybe he has to pay rent for the period of time that he was using the space. So the Beis Din ruled in this particular case that the relationship was rooted in error. Number one, Shimon made assurances that the building manager was going to be pleasant to them after the sale was completed, and it turned out to be completely the opposite of the case. And number two, he made assurances, the most important one, you could say a critical part of the transaction, if you're talking about mekach tos, of getting the bargain of your deal, the benefit of your bargain, is that they wanted to use the space for commercial purposes as a sales office, and then discovered afterwards, no, they're not allowed to use it for a sales office. So the Beis Din ruled that Reuven had the right to rescind this transaction, that this was definitely a mekach tos. Interestingly, I just, you know, was reading the decision. As I said, it's before my time. There was no discussion about an obligation to pay rent. What is the halacha, though? If that would have been asserted by Shimon, that he wants to recover rent while they were using the space, so the halacha is yes, that there is an obligation. That's always a consideration. Somebody moves into a house, and they discover that there's a major flaw in the house. After they purchase the house, they want to rescind the sale, but they've been living there for 6 months, so they have to take into consideration that while maybe they'll have the right to rescind the sale, they'll have to pay 6 months of rent to the seller in the process of doing so. I can only speculate that maybe the reason why the Beis Din in this case didn't rule that Reuven was obligated to pay rent to Shimon after the sale was rescinded, and the sale being rescinded means they give the space back to Shimon, and Shimon gives them back their money, so why is it they don't have to pay rent? It's because they wanted to use the space as a sales office. They never got off the ground. They were negotiating with the building manager to just be able to open up a shop and to begin operating, and he gave them one hurdle after another hurdle, and then finally, when all else failed, he pulled out, you know, the ace, you know, from his sleeve, that the they couldn't use it altogether because it's not zoned properly, but they never used it for a single day. So there's no rent to pay if they didn't actually live there or get any benefit from it. So I think that's probably why the Beis Din did not trigger this clause of the halacha of requiring Reuven, the defrauded purchaser, from having to pay rent to Shimon during the time that they lived in the apartment.
Would
case
be
number
a
four.
From moving expenses and ancillary expenses.
Now here's a very interesting question. You know, people ask the following. Okay, when it comes to mekach tos, and there's a very big misconception about this. They ask, does it matter if the seller, can the seller assert as a defense that he didn't know? Meaning the seller thought that this really was a viable, you know, space for zoning purposes. That's why he made the representation. It wasn't nefarious. It wasn't malicious. And the seller really thought that this was perfectly fine. Or the seller sells a car. It turns out that the car has a faulty transmission, but the seller didn't know it. The seller, you know, tested the car and everything and really thought that everything was perfectly fine. It turned out that it had faulty transmission. Is it a defense against an assertion of mekach tos for the seller to say, I just didn't know about the flaw? So often people are under that impression. They believe that if the seller can demonstrate that he or she just didn't know that there was a flaw, so then everything should be, you know, perfectly fine and they can't be held liable and the transaction should be a valid transaction. So it's not true. The halacha is that even if the seller didn't know that there was a flaw, if objectively speaking there's a flaw, then the purchaser is allowed to bring a viable, valid claim of mekach tos. It doesn't make a difference. Doesn't make a difference with respect to anything. In other words, it doesn't matter with respect to any part of the disposition of the case that the seller willfully and knowingly was aware that there was a defect and didn't disclose the defect to the purchaser. Either way, whether the seller knew or not, the purchaser is going to be able to rescind the transaction. So is there any nafka mina? So there are basically three nafka minas, okay? Two of them are stated explicitly in the Aruch HaShulchan. If you take a look in source Yud Ches on page 4, the Aruch HaShulchan goes through these different principles, all right? So he has the principle number 1, which is paragraph number 1 in Sif Yud Zayin Simen Reish Lamed Beis. If there is a major blemish, the major blemish is going to cause the transaction to be rescinded. Even if the seller didn't know about this particular mum. As long as we're able to establish that the blemish already existed before, prior to the sale of the item. Obviously, if the blemish only arose after the item was sold, so then the seller doesn't bear responsibility. That's what we call nistach basadeo. It's what we say to the purchaser. Your field got flooded over. It's not the seller's responsibility. But if the condition existed prior to the sale, so then the seller is on the hook. And he has to take the merchandise back and return the money to the lokeach. But, says the Aruch HaShulchan, there are two cases where it does make a difference. One he lists in Sif Lamed Daled, and the other he has in Sif Lamed Hey. I'll say them on the outside. Sif Lamed Daled goes like this. If the seller knows that the purchaser is going to expend certain expenses in connection with the item, like for example, the seller knows the purchaser is going to take this car and is going to drive the car from Chicago on a cross-country trip all the way to California, okay? The seller knows that this was the plan of the purchaser from the very first day. So if the seller didn't know that there was a defect with the car, only finds that afterwards, so then, whatever expenses were incurred by the purchaser in getting the car all the way from Chicago to California, so the purchaser seller is not liable for those costs. On the other hand, if the seller would be liable once, let's say that there's a defect discovered in California, and now the seller has to bring the car back to Chicago before reimbursing the purchaser for the sales price, that becomes the seller's responsibility no matter what. But in terms of the hotzos, the expenses that were incurred by the purchaser in terms of bringing it in the beginning before the defect was discovered, whatever expenses were expended at that time before the defect was discovered, what we call the original trip before the defect is known. So if the seller didn't know about the defect, the seller is not responsible. The seller did know about the defect, the seller is responsible. That's sort of picayune a little bit, but in terms of the actual application, the Sefer Shara Mishpat gives you a much more concrete application of this principle, which is, let's say, there's a purchase of a house, and it turns out the house is defective. I mean, we get these cases in the Beis Din all the time. So the seller, the purchaser says, I want to rescind the transaction. You seller, take back the house and give me back the money. And by the way, there were very significant closing costs. I had to hire a lawyer. I had to hire a title company. I had to hire an appraiser. There were like a lot of costs that I had to pay. I want all of those costs back. So according to this principle of the Aruch HaShulchan, whether the purchaser gets back all of those ancillary costs depends. If the seller knew about the defect and didn't disclose it to the purchaser, so then the purchaser has the right to demand all of those ancillary costs back from the seller. That's called garmi. It's called really direct damage that the seller caused. But if the seller did not know about the defect, so then the purchaser is only entitled to the purchase price back, but not to all of these ancillary expenses. So that's one nafka mina. A second nafka mina is sif lamed hey. Over here, if you take a look, the next paragraph in the Aruch HaShulchan. Okay, let's say that before the purchaser knew that there was a defect, the purchaser caused some sort of a damage in the item. All right. So we say that the rule is as follows. The rule is that if the purchaser just uses the item in the normal course, like let's say it's a sefer and he's underlying, lines in the sefer, so he can't be held liable when he returns the item to the seller. Seller can't say, oh, well, I want you to pay me for the reduced value because you underlined the things in the sefer, because this purchaser can say that's like the normal use of the sefer before I discovered it was a defect, and you can't hold me responsible for that. On the other hand, if the purchaser threw the item into his bathtub, which is not a normal thing to do with a sefer, to throw it in your bathtub, at least I don't throw... Do not throw this in your bathtub. It's not a normal use of the item. So then the purchaser would be held liable in a normal mekach tos case, that would be subtracted from their recovery of their original purchase price. But let's talk about what if something else happens in terms of the item getting lost or stolen. So let's say that there's a blemish and then the item gets lost or stolen. So who is responsible for that happening? So we say that, generally speaking, once the purchaser discovers that there's a blemish and lets the seller know, so now it's the seller's obligation to retrieve the item. If anything happens to the item at that point in time, so that's the seller's bad luck and not the purchaser's bad luck.
Okay?
As long as, yeah, as long at this point in time, yeah, at this point in time, once the purchaser recognizes that there's a blemish, he didn't bargain to be a shomer on this item. So as long as he gives notice to the seller to pick it up and the seller can pick it up, so then if it gets stolen at that point, it's not the purchaser's responsibility, right? However, prior to that point in time, the purchaser does bear responsibility. Prior to informing the seller, he would bear responsibility. Says the Aruch HaShulchan, that's only if the seller acted in good faith. Take a look. This is after the ellipsis, three dots before the third line of the last paragraph in the Aruch HaShulchan. Menir Ali, the call Elu Advaram Einon El Bemum Shemoke Lo Yado. But if the seller knew about the blemish, Machalo Bemirma, and he sold the item deceptively, Abitamin Bereshu Samoke Bein the Kilku Bein the Gneva Va'Aveda. So then, anything bad that happens to the item, that is the responsibility not of the purchaser, but would be the responsibility of the seller. So in our bathtub case as well, it would seem that if it turned out that it was defective merchandise, that the seller would not be able to subtract the lessened value due to the fact that it was, you know, say, mistakenly thrown into the bathtub, if it was a case where the seller had acted deceptively to begin with. So we do have these nafkaminas, which can be serious nafkaminas. They can be serious, have serious ramifications for actual bezdin cases where the purchaser is claiming mekaptos and wants to recover, you know, expenses, or the seller wants to subtract damages. So then it becomes a very relevant consideration as to whether the seller knew about the defect and didn't disclose it, or whether the seller didn't know about the defect at all. Let's go back to the case here.
Notification of the mum.
Yes.
And then it becomes the seller's responsibility. Is there a reasonable opportunity for him to retrieve it?
Yes,
or
yes.
Or does he immediately become...
It's not
he's
so
in California, he's in
right.
New York, he got to send
it's not him spelled out so clearly. If you take a look at the postgame, it seems that they allow for some sort of reasonable period. Notice, he becomes responsible at the point in time in which he could reasonably retrieve it. Right? He's a few blocks away, and he decides, oh, I'm going to wait until, you know, Monday Night Football is over, so, you know, then we don't cut him any slack. But if, you know, realistically speaking, it would take him a couple of hours, so, you know, maybe we give him the benefit of those couple of hours. Okay? All right. Now, the case number four. The Schwartz family entered into a lease agreement with the Cohn family to rent a house from them for 1 year. Also, a real Besden case, except that they weren't the Schwartzes and the Cohns, they were some other name. At the time the lease was finalized, the Cohns requested to occupy the basement of the house. The Schwartzes vacated the premises 2 months prior to the end of the lease term. They claim the transaction was a mekaptos because they discovered that the homes in their neighborhood only permitted occupancy by one family. This was the case of double occupancy, double trouble, because they really weren't allowed to have double occupancy, even though the Schwartzes agreed to it when the Cohns asked them. Probably also not a great idea to just live one floor away from your landlord. It created other tensions, but whatever. Nonetheless, they did continue to live in the premises after they discovered this fact. Are the claims of the Schwartzes valid? So here, again, you have to look at what constitutes a mekaptos and what constitutes a waiver of a mekaptos. So take a look at source 17, okay? Yud Zion on page 4, okay? This is the Aruch HaShulchan, again. This is also in the Shulchan Aruch. This is, I'm just quoting it from the Aruch HaShulchan. I'm bringing it from the Aruch HaShulchan. And this is Tshuvas HaRosh, very important Tshuvas HaRosh in the whole discussion of Mekaptos. And I'll say it on the outside, you could read it on the inside. And this was a case the Rosh dealt with Reuven and Shimon, where there was a sale by Reuven of certain houses to Shimon. And Shimon knew that these were nice houses, and he was perfectly happy to buy the houses. He investigated the houses, but prior, unbeknownst to him, prior to, because the houses were in a different town, they're sitting at the closing table, but they don't have the houses right in front of them. Like that day, a bunch of hoodlums and hooligans and vandals, they all ran inside of the house, and they created a major mess inside of the house, and they broke doors, and they ripped out the windows, and they gutted a large part of the house. So now the question is, can Shimon back out from the transaction? So Reuven says that, so Reuven says, I don't want you to back out of the transaction. There are windows that are broken, so I will give you a reduction on the purchase price so you'll have that money to fix the windows. There are doors that were torn out. I'll give you a reduction on the purchase price so you'll be able to fix the doors. Does Reuven have the right to make that assertion? Or can Shimon say, this is not what I bargained for? So the Rush says that since the windows and the doors are not the essential core of the house, they're just additional things that you add on to the house, and you can fix them, and with the right amount of money, they could be fixed, they could be just as good as new. So therefore, as long as Reuven is prepared to fix them or to make a, give a deduction on the price, in order, reduction on the price in order to enable Reuven, in order to enable Shimon to fix them, then Shimon does not have the right to back out of this transaction. When is it that Shimon has the right to back out from the transaction? If, for example, the walls are found to be rickety and the walls are about to collapse. Because you can't have a house without walls, right? So if the walls are about to collapse, so then Reuven can say to Shimon, don't worry, I'll put in new walls. Because if he's putting in new walls, you know what you have? You have a different house. It's what we call Panim Chadashos Ba'alakan. It's a different house. So that's not what Shimon purchased. Shimon purchased this house. Either this house is viable or this house is not viable. But if the house is basically viable, it just needs to have the doors and the windows repaired. So we say that doesn't go to the essence of the transaction. So you could say here as well that maybe the fact that the Schwartzes had allowed the Cones to remain within the house and just to live on a different floor, right, is not going, does not go to the essence of the habitability of the space that they rented, that we would call that to be a mekach tos per se. They could say that, oh, you know, maybe this particular thing that we agreed to, it turned out it was an error, so you should vacate the premises at this point in time. But to say, or give us a reduction, because it makes it a little bit less pleasant for us to know that we're violating, you know, the law, technically speaking, but to say that creates a bitul mekach is very, very difficult. Furthermore, even if you would make the argument that this would create a bitul mekach, a mekach tos, that would lead to a bitul mekach, it's very difficult for the Schwartzes to advance that argument when they continued to live in the space after they knew of the problem. Remember, we said that's always considered to be a waiver of the claim if the person who was cheated decides that they're not so uncomfortable with the product and merchandise after all. It's one thing if they have to use it, we mentioned last week, in an emergency, like you discover that the car is defective, but you're in the middle of the highway. So it's understandable you're going to continue to drive the car until, you know, you get to some sort of a safe location. That's not considered to be a waiver of the defect. But here, they could have just canceled the lease, but instead of canceling the lease, when it's they discovered this problem 2 months into the lease term, and then 10 months after they had maintained this arrangement, they decided they're going to cut out 2 months before the end of the lease and not paid for the last 2 months. And their argument was, well, the whole thing was a mekach tos because we discovered 2 months into the lease that really this whole setup of the Cohens continuing to live here together with us was against the zoning laws of that don't allow for double occupancy. So he said that's too little, too late in terms of the assertion. So the Beis Din ruled that they still were obligated to pay the money. Then we had the case of the Mulvey
house.
The
whole year or for the amount that they stayed there?
They were obligated to, they had already paid the rent for the past 10 months, which they wanted to, you know, recover. So that for sure they didn't get, but they even had to pay for the remaining
for the
2 months.
Months.
That's correct. Then we had a Mulvey case, okay, where there was the people who rented an apartment, again, claiming mekach tos. They left, they vacated the apartment 2 months before the end of the lease, and the argument in that case was that there was the presence of mold, that there was mold and they just couldn't take it anymore, and therefore it didn't satisfy basic habitability. But they had put up with the mold for about 10 months. They pointed to a report. The NITPA said, the seller or the landlord said, there's no mold. If you look at the report, the report just says, and again, this is an interesting case to me to read. I did sit on this case, but I was kind of like wondering, like, well, what else was, you know, said? I just read the decision. The report said that there were mold-like substances. So the landlord said, that's not mold. that's mold-like substances. Furthermore, the report said that it was basically inconclusive. So the tenant said that they had major respiratory problems and they just, you know, couldn't remain there because it was such a challenge due to the mold. But the Besdin apparently was not that sympathetic. Said, well, if there's respiratory problems, maybe it comes from other sources. Maybe it's genetic. They have allergies. But the report did not indicate conclusively that there really were mold problems. So here as well, the Besdin said that the burden of approving that there was such a serious defect in the premises that it would cancel the essential nature of the rental agreement was upon the tenant. Tenant didn't satisfy that burden, and therefore the tenant was obligated to not only pay for the amount of time they had already been there, but to continue to pay for the remaining 2 months that were left on the lease, even though they had moved out. So again, the way in which the facts are interpreted by a Besdin depends very much on a case-by-case basis, but these are some of the different considerations.
Does Besdin only get involved if the lawsuit is filed, or if somebody came to and said, look, here's the situation, is this worth pursuing in Besdin or not? Are you allowed to respond to that, or you can't even... In other words, I have a mold-like substance. Is this a Din Torah case or is this not a Din Torah case? Are you allowed to answer that or do you have to wait until they actually, both parties
Somebody comes and they say, is this the type of case I can bring to Besdin? So certainly a Besdin administrator can say, yes, if you have a claim for defective merchandise or that you didn't get the benefit of your bargain, that's certainly the type of case you could bring to Besdin. But I can't tell you whether you would prevail on the merits or not. But if this is the type of case to bring to Besdin, as opposed to, say, bringing to secular court, that it's a type of case that would be adjudicated by a Besdin, by all means, it's the type of case that we would adjudicate. Nothing wrong with having that type of a conversation with a Besdin, as long as it doesn't go beyond that, as long as one doesn't go into all of the substantive details, which would already be inappropriate if the person on the other end of the phone might be sitting on the case, because that's something that would have to be heard in the presence of both sides. I saw a case from the chief rabbinate, from one of the courts of the rabbinate in Eretz Yisrael, of one of the Rabbanu courts, involving somebody who purchased a house, and the house was near like a stone quarry, and then they discovered that it was not really secured so well, and after they purchased the house, they would walk out into their yard, walk out of the front door, and stones would fall all over the place, and they were afraid that they were just going to get pelted or, whacked by one of the stones. So the purchaser brought a claim for mekach tos, and the seller said the purchaser actually said, I want to keep the house, but I want you, the seller, to fix this problem so that this will be safe, because when you sell a house, you're supposed to sell something which is basically safe, where there aren't stones which are falling on my head all over the place. This is sort of an interesting, weird case. Right. You can secure it, and so forth. So the Besdin, interestingly there as well, just kind of reversed turned the tables and said that, it's just like a seller can say that if it's the type of thing where they can fix the problem and make everything 100% fine by repairing the windows and the doors, for example, of a house that got vandalized, so to a purchaser in a similar type case can say, look, this doesn't go to the essential nature of the house. I don't have to assert bitul mekach, but I have a right to assert that the seller is obligated to enable the house to be in the proper condition for habitability, and therefore I can insist that the seller fix this problem and at the same time maintain the sale. Because the seller said, you want me to fix the problem? I'm not fixing the problem. You don't like the house? Give me back the money and give me back the house and I'll give you back the money. So the Besdin said he doesn't have the right to do it in this case, because this is not intrinsic to the house, where it's an automatic bitul mekach, but rather it's something that can be fixed, and it's serious enough that it's something that really the seller should be burdened with the responsibility that they absolutely should fix it. We'll do the last case and we'll finish. Okay, so, and then I'll be happy to inscribe the Sfarim, Bezrat Hashem. So, last case, A orders merchandise from B to sell to C, who generally sells to D, knowing that B receives merchandise from E. I'm sure you will follow that, because it's very, very simple, okay? We had this case, it's a very interesting case, somebody ordered plastic bags, okay? And there was a vendor who, he would receive a request for an order of plastic bags, so we had a manufacturer who prepared the bags. He himself didn't even have anything to do with looking at the bags. He would just order it from the manufacturer. The manufacturer would ship it directly to the customer, and then the customer who received the bags would sell it to his customers. It turned out there was a problem with these plastic bags. I don't know, the ink was fading on it, the company name wasn't clear, it was very difficult to open the bags. Major problem with the bags, it was a huge, huge order for the shipment of the bags. So when this was pointed out by the customer, okay, who had received the bags from the supplier, and the customer had passed it on to his own clients, so the supplier said, well, you know, for me to get the money back, to give you the money back, I need the bags so I can give the bags back to the manufacturer. He said, but I gave the bag to my customer, and the customer, you know, and the bags were already used, but they discovered that there was a major flaw with the bags. So this raises the question, so can the supplier say, well, I don't have to give you your money back unless you give me the item? So here as well, this goes to that the principle that we discussed earlier, when it's known by the supplier that the purchaser is going to use the bags or the item in such a way that if it turns out to be defective, they won't be able to give it back. Like the classic case is seeds. They receive seeds to plant in the ground, and it turns out the seeds were defective. They're not going to be able to return the seeds afterwards, you know. The case of Zeroyim, you know, that were Shizaro Bakarka, you're not going to be able to return it afterwards. So this is a similar type case. But then the other, you know, claim that that you might potentially have is that the seller could say, maybe it's not my responsibility because I get the bags directly from the manufacturer. I'm just the middle guy. I'm just the middleman. This is a big machlokus in the Shulchan Aruch. There's the middleman. If let's say a purchaser knows that the person who's giving them the merchandise is really just the middleman himself, so does that impose a higher level of responsibility on the purchaser? Do we say no? Even then, despite the fact that it's known that the middleman doesn't really have a chance to look at the product, the middleman still bears responsibility. It's dependent upon how you understand the certain Gemara in Bava Metzia Daf Mem Dalet about, you know, somebody who was a middleman who purchased an ox, and the ox turned out not to have any teeth, and the middleman didn't really look at the ox, but gave it over to a shepherd, and the shepherd mixed up that ox with all the other oxen that were around, and that ox died because it didn't have any teeth. And who bore responsibility? Was it the purchaser? Was it the seller? And according to the Gemara, it sounds like it was the purchaser who bore responsibility, so that's what the Mechaber rules, that's what the Shulchan Aruch rules, and the Rama says, no, that was just a very, very strange case. You can't really derive general principles from that case. But as a general rule, the person, even if he's just a middleman, he does bear a certain measure of responsibility, unless the purchaser was just extremely negligent. In this case, the purchaser wasn't extremely negligent, just passed on the bags like they're supposed to. It only turned out there was a problem with the bags, whether the bags were actually used, and he discovered the ink was running, it was difficult to open, and so forth and so forth. So therefore, in this case, the seller would bear a certain measure of responsibility, but since the bags were used, so then the Maharsham has a tshuva about this case. That's the last source in the materials, that's the Maharshdam, and the Maharshdam says that this really depends upon what was the ultimate value that was received, meaning that since there was some value that the customer received, when the customer passed on the bags to their own clients, they received some money, they gave a discount because the bags turned out not to be so good, so then the amount that would have to be paid would just be the reduction in value between what it was expected to be worth and what in the end it ended up being worth, and the seller would only have to, would be on the hook, but would only have to pay the differential between those two amounts. So in our case, it happens that the purchaser had given a full discount, had given a full credit to his own customers, but we said that the seller is not obligated to, you know, give the same amount of credit that was given. If it was more than was really warranted according to halacha, they're not obligated to make up for the generosity, you know, of their client towards their client's customers. So therefore, we figured out a formula along those lines. The bottom line, you know, is that these cases come up on a semi-regular basis. The cases for defective merchandise, cases for fraudulent transactions. In every single case, a Beis Din has to make a couple of determinations. One determination is: are we dealing with an onah case where where the product is what it was supposed to be? It's just that it was either overcharged or undercharged. Or are we dealing with a mekach tos case where there's a problem with the merchandise itself? If we are dealing with a mekach tos case, are we dealing with a case where the flaw is so essential and so intrinsic to the nature of the merchandise that therefore the transaction has to be completely canceled? Or is it something that can be fixed, in which case the remedy is more fixing it than canceling it? And finally, if it was a defect in the merchandise, is there any argument to say that the purchaser bore some responsibility, that they should have checked it out beforehand based on the circumstances? And furthermore, is this a type of case where the seller either knew about it or really should have known about it? And if the seller really knew about the defect, then we're going to impose a higher measure of responsibility upon the seller than in other types of cases. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see what we have.
Well, what if the item is perishable? What if you milk on the...